Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Lords of Limited. My name is Ben Warney, and joining me on the line, as always, Mr. Ethan, patient naturalist Sachs. Ethan, I came in hot to the podcast today. You've got me calmed down a little bit. We've got some scuttle to talk about. Green is good in this format.
No, green is the best. It's the greatest. The uncontested, only draft green only can win with green, right?
Exactly. So here's the podcast today, folks. Put some green cards in your deck. Add some forests, best card in the draft format, and you will win. Problem
Step
solved.
Three, boom. Profit.
5 minute podcast in, out. We got the format solved.
So this is first of all, you and I have not spoken this entire week. I've watched a little bit of your stream where you were very salty about the green life. And what we're referencing here is, like, if you are not on Magic Twitter, if you do not check 17 lands, like, that was the, like, day one takeaway was, like, green is incredible. And there was a lot like that. And that was not, I think, our experience from, or I'll speak for myself, not my experience from the weekend, from early access, not my experience from, you know, prepping for the crash course. And I was a little like, okay, like, when the data says something is great, it usually is great. But this also feels like the most, I don't know, it feels like a lot of noise for something where we've only got a day of information, you know? So I was trying to really, like, temper that. You perhaps not tempering it so much.
Well, to be clear, that's all tongue in cheek.
Yeah.
I am still data free. I have not opened 17 lands other than to do our tier list. And normally I check it out for this podcast and, like, compare my thoughts mm-hmm. to the data, but I assume you have looked and can be that voice for me.
Yeah, I've got the tab up.
And there's been enough noise about 17 lands that I feel like I've looked at it. But in all seriousness, green is very good. Like, yes. I am on team green. I think it is just a little overblown by the data and everybody looking at it and then wanting to talk about it in Twitch chat. And some of that might just be from streaming. Like, we probably get inundated Correct. With it from streaming. But green is very good, and we'll get into that in this episode and why. But I don't think the gap is as large as people are making it seem like it is to me. I think everything's pretty draftable. There's a couple decks I would want to stay away from, but I also think the color rankings are fairly close as well.
I do too. I mean, I'm going to be curious. I've been really trying to, I don't know, I've been trying to cook a little bit this week to try and figure out some other stuff. Like, everyone kept talking about green. I was like, I can't stop drafting Grixis. I'm not saying that I think Grixis is very good. We'll get to my own personal journey this week with the format in just a little bit. But yeah, we got a lot to get to, a lot to dive into.
Well, and we should talk about where we're coming from, right? Because I have only done best of one on Arena to this point, right? And you have Correct. Explored best of three and playing on Magic Online a little bit, and I will be joining you next week there. But I wanted to do what I think most of our listeners are doing this first week, which is playing on best of one. Also, I think that's how you get the most info the fastest.
That's fair, and I, you know, am allowed to have this change, but I am currently in my, like, little spiky life of, like, oh, I'm going to be RCQing and whatever, and there's a sealed tournament on Magic Online next weekend, and whatever, there's the Arena Open. All that stuff is best of three, so I'm going to be playing best of three, and we're now both in the Magic Online creator program, and so, like, you'll be seeing more Magic Online content from us in the coming, you know, months or whatever to fulfill that obligation. So that's just what I've been doing. And best of three on Arena is just not it yet. Like, one out of, like, in a run, one of my opponents has some, like, 52 card monstrosity. And it's just like, it's just not the competition I'm seeking. So I've mostly been playing best of three on Magic Online. That is correct.
But that might inform different perspectives we have about the format, I think, for sure.
Correct. Okay, let's get into some housekeeping stuff and dive into the episode. First things first is the Patreon page. Patreon.com/LordsOfLimited is where folks can go to give back to the show if they so choose. Everybody who gives back via the Patreon gets access to the Lords of Limited Discord. It is the best. I truly believe this deep down in my heart. It is the best place on the internet for 24/7 limited tech support. It's just the best community. There's so much happening. There's so many different conversations. And early in a format, it just can't be beat. It's unparalleled. And I'll just let the new patrons this week speak for themselves here as we welcome into the fray Tim, aw yeah, Skylar, Olga, Bernstein, Darwin, Jake, Kami, Jackie, Cannon, Justin, Lord Spug, Michael, Drake, Sig, John, Robert, and Jonathan. Thank you, thank you, thank you. We really appreciate your support. Ben, can I get a classic from you?
Holy patrons, Batman.
Yeah, you love, love, love to see it. And we've got our first JLK What's the Play to kick off Outlaws of Thunder Junction.
Let's dive in.
Okay, so this is from the man, the myth, the legend himself, Josh Lee Kwai. It boils down to a question about sequencing with Crimeland. So he says, let's say you have an opener with both a 2-drop and a 3-drop, one basic land and 2 crime lands. For the sake of the example, let's say the other 2 cards in your hand are 4+ mana value drops. So let's say a 4-drop and a 5-drop. So he says, I play the tap land on turn 1, but assuming I draw a blank on turn 2, how do I think about the next play? Do I put the basic down and play my 2-drop? There's always the possibility that I hit a basic off the top next turn or another 2-drop, right? So then it's not so punishing. Or do I play the second tap land and prioritize playing my 3-drop next turn? And, you know, like the answer to many Magic questions, the real answer is it depends, right? Because context is so important, what your opponent does, what your deck's game plan is. But we're going to try, I think the essence of this question is answerable for us, as Ben is smirking at me that he's got a million questions. So I'll tee it up to you, Ben, if you have some clarifying questions before we can get into some answers here.
Not clarifying questions. I just think this is such a wide
question. Very broad.
I don't know that it's answerable in a certain sense. Like I would need to know what my 2-drop is, what my 3-drop is, what my deck's game plan is, what lands my opponent started with, informing me about how aggressive I expect their deck to be, the power level of my 2-drop, the power level of my 3-drop. Like, it's never going to be the same answer, I don't think. There's probably a general thing that you want to do, which would be, I think my default, given no known information about this thing, would be to play my 2-drop on 2. But because of what JLK said, which is you have a chance of drawing your third untapped land, or you have a chance of drawing another 2-drop.
So my answer is different. I think so, and this is my thought process, and perhaps it's OTJ specific, and that may lead us nicely into my growing pains for the week and discussing our experience with the format for the first week. But my feeling is I want to play Crimeland on 2 so that I can ensure my 3-drop and likely ensure my 4-drop on time. And I think that is more important in this format than getting your 2-drop down on time. Now, again, it depends is there, like if my opponent plays something aggressive or whatever, and or I think I've got a really high chance of drawing an untapped land or a 2-drop that I'll play my 2-drop on time. But I think, you know, the stuff gets compounded. He asks a little later on, like, what if it's 2 crime lands and an untapped land and you have 1-drop, 2-drop, 3-drop? Like, do you play untapped land and 1-drop on 1 and then likely play off curve the rest of the game? That doesn't feel right. But like, what are you doing? Do you leave your 1-drop by the wayside? Like in that example, I would think I would likely go Crimeland on 1, Crimeland and my 1-drop on 2 to then be able to play my 3-drop on 3. And that I feel like is a little easier to answer. But my feeling is I just don't, like, it gets compounded missing out on curving out the higher up the curve you go, I think. So like, yeah, you guarantee your 2-drop, but then you might stumble on 3 and 4. I'd rather skip 2, guarantee 3, likely guarantee 4 on time. I think that's more important.
I just think there's so many more factors to be able to answer it than that. Like, I think if you have the 2-2 lifelinker in a black deck, you want to get that down on turn 2 to start swinging for lifelink damage. Or maybe if your 3-drop blocks well and you anticipate being on the back foot, like let's say it's the Patient Naturalist. Maybe you want to wait and get Patient Naturalist down because it's also going to help you find your fourth land. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, there's... I can construct examples for the 2-drop or the 3-drop in my head. Also, if you insert rares into either slot, like you want to get your best card down. Like to me, it's more about power level and how I anticipate getting the most power out of my hand early on the board, or getting the most defense out of my hand early on the board, or whatever I anticipate needing. That's the thought process I would be using my hand. Like, I don't think we can give people a heuristic for this, but I do think the heuristic for what to do is, what do I want the most of? Like, do I need the most power? Do I need the most defense? Do I need the most offense from my hand? What am I trying to do? And then use those questions to inform figuring out whether you're supposed to play the 2-drop or the 3-drop on curve. There's also in this format, specifically for crime lands, does your deck want to commit crimes? If so, maybe you're incentivized to not slam that second crime land on turn 2, and you do play the 2-drop, hoping to be able to sandbag your crime land for a 3 or a 4-drop that cares about crime lands, you know?
Yeah, I think like any specific scenario you can, like, I appreciate the question from Josh being general, but I feel like it would almost be more helpful to give us like 10 specific examples, because I bet you and I would come to the same conclusion for most of them. Like, of like, well, in this scenario, you want to do this. Oh, in this scenario, you definitely want to do this. Like, so I think it's apparent when you see the specifics, but as a general question, it's probably just too broad to answer.
Boom. We got him.
Boom. We got him. All right. Are we ready for a little growing pains story time?
There's
my journey
been
this week.
A lot of growing pains in this format. This format is cool. First of all, like, let's get that out there. We haven't talked about that much. This is my first time playing the format. This format is awesome.
I'm not as hot on it, I think, as the rest of the world right now.
Ooh.
And I don't know if that's because I'm trying to see if it's, am I struggling with it? And that's why I'm not like enjoying it. Or are there some fundamental things about it that don't quite jive with me? So I'm reserving judgment. I'm enjoying myself, but like, it's hard for me to imagine week one of any Magic format, me not saying I'm enjoying myself. So I don't know if that's, you know, unique to this.
That's fair, but I am willing to say week one, I'm not enjoying myself, and I'm enjoying myself a lot.
I love that. Okay, so earlier this week, I posted this screenshot on Twitter. It had, in my three drop slot, had two Vault Plunderers, two Erasable Wolverines, and five Prickly Pears. Vault Plunderer being the 3-mana 3-1, ETBs, target player draws a card, loses a life. Wolverine is the plot, ETBs, you exile the top card of your library, and until end of turn, you can play it. And Prickly Pear is the 3-mana 2-2, brings along a 1-1 mercenary. And I said, did I miss the memo where 2-for-1s aren't good and limited anymore? Because I was getting these late, like last pick Wolverine.
Well, and this was a Kappa flexing post, right? Not really truly introspective. And then it turned introspective.
Correct. Yes. Yes. I was mostly making a like a ha 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 joke. And then I got various replies, three of which I'd like to highlight. Andrew Ellenbogen said, honestly, yes. Alexander Hain said, you have to actually trade with your opponent's cards to be a 2-for-1. And their cards are rares that win the game that don't exchange for a 3-power dude. Mike Sigrist, commons are washed, TBH. And my initial reaction to this was very like the Seymour Skinner, am I wrong? No, it's the children who are wrong or whatever. Have I lost touch? But I thought about it and I was like, I think they're right. And this was also part, like, whatever. This deck ended up trophying in a best of three on Arena. But that, like I said before, I don't think that's saying much. And I think these kinds of cards were a trap for me in the first few days. Not that they are not good, but all the cards are good, and so these cards are not that special, is my current takeaway. I also was watching a bit of Brian Kibler's stream, and like it was truly like I like clicked on it, and this was the soundbite I got immediately. And he was like, limited used to be about incremental value. Zap was a good card, and that's 2 in a red, instant speed, deal a damage to something, draw a card. And he was like, that was a good card because it let you get ahead on incremental value. Sets now are more about tempo and synergy than value. And I'm like, looking at this 3-drop slot of 9 value commons, and I'm not feeling good about it. And I'm hearing this and I'm trying to internalize it. And I think this is all right. Like, I'm not saying these cards aren't good. But every card is, air quotes, good. So what makes these special? And I think Haynes' point about bombs don't care about value, but also the most powerful curve outs in the format don't really care about these cards.
Yes, I agree. It's very much the Incredibles, if everything is super, yes, nothing is super, except there are still some super duper cards.
Correct.
In the format. But like these normal commons that would be, Vault Plunder would be easy top common in most formats, like no thought, a 3-1 that gets you a card, but it also gets knocked down by mercenary tokens running around, so it is kind of hard to trade it for a real card. But some draws, it's still absolutely incredible. Prickly Pear, also just a very good Magic card. It's just a little small ball somehow, yes, despite being a very good limited Magic the Gathering card. This is much closer to Cube, I think. You know, we said that about March of the Machines.
Yeah.
But I think this one really, truly is closer to Cube in that, like, Prickly Pear is not holding water in Cube. And I think Prickly Pear would have held water in the Rakdos deck in March of the Machines.
Uh-huh.
But this truly, to me, is a Prince format. Like, for the first time. You know, we've gotten rid of Prince Pauper. Like, you don't want commons in your deck in this format. You want rares and uncommons and a few key commons that support them.
Yeah.
Not that there aren't common archetypes. And I do think there are some Pauper archetypes inside of the prints format, but I think largely the rares and the uncommons are driving the show here.
I totally agree. And that framing that led me to understanding more about why I think green is putting up early numbers and other colors not so much. And so that's going to lead me into what my feeling of like rules of engagement are for the set. So,
well, I want to pick your brain before we do these rules of engagement. Why do you think green is putting up early numbers? Because I have a very specific idea in my head too. And it sounds like from what you prefaced that with, that we might have a different idea of why.
So it's hard for me to not have some folks that have expressed this to me have this thought in my head, which is that, like, you know how like aggro puts up early numbers usually is because it's like pretty straightforward, and green is pretty straightforward in the format. But my feeling about why it's putting up early numbers is stats. It's rate of like when that 5/4 trample ETB gain 3 life, whether you're plotting it on 4, whether you're hard casting it on 5, that thing is big. Giant Beaver is giant. Like, and that is not even that good of a card, but like it just has big rate stuff. And I know this from playing a bunch of fiddly Grixis decks, that when you're playing your Blood Hustler, your 2-mana 1/1, when you commit a crime, it grows, but only once a turn, and they just drop a 3-mana 3/3, you are, to use the common parlance, scrambling.
I agree. Okay, so maybe we are on the same page. I agree. Green is huge. Green gets stats at a very good rate. We're going to talk about efficiency later in the format, and green stats are very efficient, and it is hard to be, you know, there's scuttle also going around about, well, they've finally done it. This is a slower format. Da, 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 da. Like, there's not one drops everywhere, but there aren't, but you have a 2-mana 3/3 into a 3-mana 3/3 into a 4-mana 4/4 with cards that help them grow. Like, green is the beatdown deck of the format at common. Mm-hmm. Green, white, and green, red, like, those are the two best aggressive decks and the two best decks that exist, like a traditional limited deck. I think commons and uncommons, sure, they can get help from great rares that snowball, but you don't have to. And I think they're very threat dense, and that's hard for some decks to keep up with and compete with. But it's got that. So green is the aggressive color, but it's also the color with the most bombs. Like, green gets it all. It gets to be the level one beatdown decks. It gets to be the late game bombs decks and cover the ground in between. There's also green
around.
There's also green synergy archetypes, like green black has tons of synergy going on while also just putting lots of stats on the table. It gets to do a lot of different things.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree. I think green is good. I don't want to come to this episode and be like, oh, that is like whatever. People don't know what's going on. Green isn't that good. It's overblown. Like, green is obviously very good. I just don't think it's the be all end all. Like, if you don't end up in green, you're going to lose type of deal.
Yes, for sure. I would agree with that statement as well.
Thanks to Miracle Made for sponsoring this episode. Did you know that your temperature at night can have one of the greatest impacts on your sleep quality? As we move towards summer and temperatures are changing, if you wake up too hot or too cold, I highly recommend you check out Miracle Made's bed sheets.
Inspired by NASA, Miracle Made uses silver-infused fabrics and makes temperature-regulating bedding so you can sleep at the perfect temperature all night long.
These sheets are at the top of my household's power rankings. I always want to blast the heat in the winter and the AC in the summer, and my wife does not. But luckily, Miracle Made helps us compromise and make sure we both get a good night's sleep.
These sheets are infused with silver that prevent up to 99.7% of bacterial growth, leaving them to stay cleaner and fresh 3 times longer than other sheets. No more gross odors.
Go to trymiracle.com/LOL to try Miracle Made sheets today. And whether you're buying them for yourself or as a gift for a loved one, if you order today, you can save over 40%.
And if you use our promo code LOL at checkout, you'll receive 3 free towels and save an extra 20%. And if you aren't 100% satisfied, Miracle has a 30-day money-back guarantee.
Upgrade your sleep with Miracle Made. Go to trymiracle.com/LOL and use code LOL to claim your free 3-piece towel set and save over 40%.
Again, that's trymiracle.com/LOL to treat yourself. And now, back to the show.
So, rules of engagement. The format is powerful. Like, feel like we say it every other set. Well, this set's like cube. This set's like cube. Like, this set is like cube. Truly, like, game plan number one should be draft bombs, put them in your deck. Look at the upper left corner of your pack on Magic Online or Magic Arena and hope that you get to select that card and that it makes your deck at the end of the draft.
Yes, I would agree. But I also think there's way more to do than just that. Like, you can certainly open packs with whatever, a land and an unplayable rare and an unplayable bonus sheet card and feel deflated. Like, how am I going to keep up? But I do think there are ways to keep up with the bombs.
Yes. So I think, and I said this, I think this is not quite the right word, but I want to unpack this a little bit. I wrote draft engines if you don't get bombs and go under people if you don't have bombs or engines. Engines is not the right thing. Like, engines is something we used to describe, like when we were drafting Kaladesh Remastered, if you're like doing fiddly energy things or getting the modules together or whatever. There's not really that yet, I will say, that I've explored. Like, I don't think I've experienced like, I combine card A and B and C and they form this sort of machine together. But it's more like, I guess build arounds is the thing. Like the card that came to mind is Rise of the Varmints. Like if you draft a deck where Rise of the Varmints is making 6, 7, 2/1s, you know, that's an engine. That's not really an engine, but like, that's what I sort of mean. Like that playing Doc Orlok on 2 into plot on 3. Like that sort of stuff.
Yeah. Those are build arounds, though, more than engines. Yeah. Like, so to me, engines, and I have done this, but I don't think it's great. Like Baron plus the Treasure Dredger plus the Hoarding Dragon that poops out. But that stuff's all a little cutesy, like you said, because the problem with engines, I think, is you end up in a spot in the middle where like you're going to get mauled by the green decks that are curving out and playing Throw from the Saddle, which is just an incredible card. One in a green, put a +1/+1 counter, and then your creature deals damage equal to its power to another creature. And if it was a mount, you get a +1/+1 counter. That card is illegally good in the format. You're going to lose to those decks, while also, like, you're by nature of engines, they want to accrue incremental value, which means you want to get to the late game, where you're also just in danger of people losing to just having way better cards than you.
Exactly. Yes. So I agree. I agree with that for sure. Because of it being a Prince format, and we should say, because we never talk about sets this way, but Prince versus Pauper format is an old framing device for sets. So basically, like, Pauper format is a format dictated by its commons. Prince format is a format dictated by its rares. I think that is the world we're living in now, certainly with OTJ. And because of that, catch-all removal is incredibly important. You will face powerful cards. You need to be able to answer them.
Yes, I agree. Removal's been great. I do want to back up to Prince format, though, because I think oftentimes it also has a negative connotation.
Correct.
And I think this is a really cool, really good Prince format, because the power level's just raised everywhere. It's not like, I think in Prince formats of old, it would be, well, the rares invalidated everything, so nothing else mattered.
Uh-huh.
And there are definitely some rares that can do that here, but the uncommons are so juiced, too. Like, I think everything just got pushed up a little bit. And I think it makes for a very fun, interesting, swingy format.
Yeah.
And so if it's a Prince format and we have all these rares running around, we, as you said, need the removal to be able to answer them. I agree that catch-all removal is very good. I do think you have to be careful about what style of deck you're playing. And again, I think we'll get into this when we get into the archetypes a little bit later in the episode. But you can't jam 8 removal spells in your deck that's trying to end the game early. I think one of the things this format rewards the most is having a clear idea of when and how you're trying to end the game. And it can be, yes, I think the advice of catch all removal is important. You should put removal in your deck. I think all of that advice is good. And my best decks have been able to interact with the opponent very well. Like, I've struggled when I've only had a removal spell or two, like I would in some formats.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, let's say you're red-black Outlaws, for example, which is a deck that I think is good, got a lot of potential, but not, like, certainly not the week one decks to be drafting. The green decks are just better than that most of the time when they come together. But you can also get yourself in a lot of trouble, I think, in red-black by playing 7 or 8 removal spells. And I think at its core, red-black is an aggro deck, or trying to be an aggro deck in the format. And then if you get draws where you draw too many removal spells, then all of a sudden you're reacting, you find yourself in the mid to late game, and you're just going to be like, well, this format's stupid. I'm losing to my opponent's rares. But I think if you had better deck building for the red-black deck and been trying to end the game at the appropriate time for the red-black deck, you can save yourself some of that pain of losing to bombs. Not always, but I think more than otherwise would happen if you don't let your deck get to the point in the game where it's not supposed to be.
Yeah, but that isn't format specific. Like, that's just limited 101, but like your aggro deck needs to be threat dense and not answer dense. Like the longer you want the game to go on, the more answers you need. That's just like good limited deck building across any format.
Sure, but I think the advice, like just to a general listener, like if I get a draft once or twice a week, like this format can lead to a ton of feel bads, I think. If you draft once or twice a week, and if we say, and I, you know, I've heard other people talking about, well, removal's good, like you need a lot of removal. If you then draft your black-red deck and you have 8 removal spells because Lords of Limited said removal's good, I think you can find yourself in a bit of a spot.
I like you're already doing damage control, the PR PR damage control, covering our bases. Yes, I agree. But and the phrase catch-all, meaning something like Consuming Ashes versus Desert's Dew, right? Like having something that just answers the thing unequivocally without any sort of setup, without needing... I mean, Throw from the Saddle is sort of like, it's so good because it's so cheap and green's bodies are so big that it is often catch-all. But like, even that requires some setup. And so like, just thinking about, you know, if as long as you are threat dense in a green deck with good rates, like Throw from the Saddle is going to be excellent. But there is a world where you can draft a deck where Throw from the Saddle is not that excellent. So just thinking about how your removal, what setup your removal needs and how it answers various threats you're going to face. Can we chat about rate?
Let's do it.
Okay, rate matters a ton. I have, as I said, the start of the format, I played a lot of Grixis. I've not played a lot of green. It is not crazy open on Magic Online. Like, I think people just know what's up, and it's not that easy to get into green. I've sort of bullied my way in there, depending on the rares I've opened, but naturally getting into it has not been that easy. So I've played a lot of Grixis. I've actually played a good bit of blue control decks. We'll chat about those later. But the creatures are too small in these colors. You get outclassed really quickly by green's threats. And that's why I think Throw from the Saddle is performing so well. It's like the green creatures just match up so well with everything else. Throw from the Saddle lets you double spell, enables attacks, etc. I've already talked about Blood Hustler. I was excited about Raven of Fell Crimes last week. I am so much less excited about Raven of Fell Crimes this week because it's just so small. Not to say I haven't seen that card be good. Like, I drafted a really cool double Blood Hustler deck, and then my opponent was just like, bounce it. Kill it. I was like, what the heck am I supposed to do? And then I've got this derpy 1/2 flyer that I paid 2 mana for, and other people are spending 2 mana to play 3/3s. So like, you just like, you have to make sure everything is going right for that deck. Otherwise, you're just gonna get rolled, I think, by larger bodies.
Right. The difference between green beatdown decks and like the red black or blue, like, because I think you're probably describing, what was it, black red or blue black crimes, tempo aggro,
either, any, whatever, which pick your deck. I don't want to draft.
Sure. Yeah, like the difference is the green decks get to just play cards,
yes,
that attack and kill you, while you're trying to like draw your cards in the right order to and grow them to a size that can attack and kill you. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. One of them is no batteries included, and yeah, one of them is batteries included. You and just, the green decks get the batteries included.
You spend every turn just being like, just give me a second, please. Just let me, just everyone relax and just let me do my thing.
Well, and I think you see it boiling down to Snakeskin Veil versus Take Up the Shield. You know, last week we were saying Take Up the Shield on notice. From what I've heard from the stats, again, haven't opened 17 lands, but it seems like Take Up the Shield is performing very well on 17 lands. I think Snakeskin Veil is better because it gives hexproof. Like, it just literally stops everything.
Yes.
For 1 mana. And I think you are less worried about the lifelink in this format than in formats past, with the exception of if you're probably in that green-white mirror or those green-red mirrors. I could see Take Up the Shield being great there, but generally I want to spend 1 mana to protect my thing versus 2. It's tough to hold up 2 mana while you're sequencing your threats.
I completely co-sign that. And Snakeskin Veil is really good. It's really, really good for that ability to just slot in along the curve. And for what you're saying, like, it dodges Mystical Tether, the exile enchantment. It dodges Bounce. Like, you just get to say, nope, you're not interacting with my thing.
Well, and the other thing that it does that's incredible is, you know, we're going to get into the archetypes and kind of what the pillars of the format are and how they all operate. But the decks that prey on the green beatdown decks the most, green, white, and green, red, are like Grixis, Crimes, I'm going to kill all your stuff. Mm-hmm. And Snakeskin Veil is the best thing you can be packing against Grixis, Crimes, Control.
So this, I think, is just, anecdotal from my best of three experience. It's small sample size, whatever. I have been leaning towards 18 lands because I have felt that missing land drop number three is basically game over. Even if you have things to do with two mana, the two mana stuff is often just too small ball. And I just like, I just hate not being able to hit my third land drop. There's also an aspect of like some aggressive splashing on my part without perhaps the requisite fixing. And so I've needed 18 lands for sources to get to like eight of my main two colors and then have two or three for my splash and just dipping into basics for that. The power level of cards in this format, I think, does dictate that that's okay sometimes. But that has led me to be playing 18 lands, I think, more often than not.
I've only done it once, and it was for a situation you described. I just needed numbers of sources because I hadn't gotten enough crime lands. But in general, I've played 17, and especially in the late game bomb decks, like it's really easy to draft green soup in the format that plays a lot of powerful cards. Call it the green desert deck, call it what you will. But it's essentially you're trying to get the late game and then cast all the rares that people passed you that they shouldn't have passed you. You really have to be conscious in that deck, especially on Arena, I think, of the amount of air or irrelevant cards that you have in your deck.
Yeah, I buy that for sure. My last point here, I know I keep wanting to come in and be like, well, this mechanic stinks or this mechanic stinks. But I do think going back to the rate mattering a ton, I think spree cards, maybe not more cute than good is the way to describe them, but like just comparing, go to the catch-all removal side of things. Consuming Ashes, 2BB, exile a thing. If it's mana value 3 or less, you surveil 2. Versus Unfortunate Accident, which is the spree uncommon removal spell that can be 4 mana, destroy a creature, or 5 mana, destroy a thing, get a mercenary. I think Ashes is just better than Accident. Full
stop. I agree.
Partially because, well, you're like, well, but Unfortunate Accident just lets you, you know, you get a 1/1 for one extra mana if you want. I think the exile matters a lot. I think the possibility to surveil matters a lot on Ashes. And I just think, like, what's the card in blue? It's like Metamorphic something, the thing that turns your opponent's thing into a 0/1 rabbit until end of turn, and you can draw two cards.
Oh, that card is horrible.
It really is. But that's another one. Like, remember how, like, last week I was like, I kept getting whatever, the counterspell late, and I was like, people don't know. I kept getting, like, that card late, and I was like, this is a 3-for-1. People don't know. It's like, no, this card is so fiddly.
It needs to remove all abilities, or it needs to...
Yeah, that's true.
Like, there's just so many times you want to use it to, like, kill a flyer, but you can't, because your thing doesn't have flying that you want to block with, or... Yeah, I have played with that card quite a bit, and I have been thoroughly mad at it every time it's been in my hand. And can I just get two cards out of this? Can I just get it out of my hand?
Right. Can I pay too much mana to draw two cards, please? And that's just like not a spot you want to be in.
But I do think there are some spree cards that are good.
Sure. Yeah. But like, I mean, they're good. Like, you want, like, they're good because the rate of them is good. Like, not because of the possibility of, if I do all the things, I will have slightly overpaid for a 2-for-1 or a 3-for-1. That is not, like, that has been the mental shift for me about spree cards that I want to encourage people, if you're not there, to have.
Yes. Like, for example, the ones that when they do something plus give your stuff a bonus when you stick them, like the white one, if you ever blow up an artifact or an enchantment and then give your team +1/+1, that one's incredible. Or the green one that can put counters and give trample and draw you cards. Like, they're, yes, I would agree. The way to think about spree is if they're good cards or not, rather than just like decrying spree as a mechanic or whatever, slandering spree as a mechanic.
Correct.
I don't think is the way to go. There just happen to be a lot of spree cards that are not great.
That you're
cards.
Just overpaying for a bunch of things. And then when you combine them all, it's like, yeah, I got a 3-for-1. It's like, yeah, but you paid so much more than you should for it.
This podcast is sponsored by Squarespace, the all-in-one website platform for entrepreneurs to stand out and succeed online. Whether you're just starting out or managing a growing brand, Squarespace makes it easy to create a beautiful website, engage with your audience, and sell anything from products to content to time, all in one place, all on your terms.
Squarespace is such an easy product for us to get excited about because we've been using them for years. I was really daunted by the idea of designing a website, but the interface behind Squarespace makes it so that even a tech noob like me can get something up and running.
With Fluid Engine, the next generation website editor from Squarespace, it's never been easier for anyone to unlock unbreakable creativity. Choose your website starting point and customize every design detail with reimagined drag and drop technology for desktop or mobile.
Easily launch your website and get discovered fast with integrated, optimized SEO tools so you show up more often to more people and grow the way you want.
Measure your end-to-end online performance with powerful website and seller analytics. Get insights on top traffic sources, understand how your reach is growing, and learn where to focus new engagement.
Oh, wow, there's even a way to upload video content, organize your video library, and showcase your content on beautiful video pages. I guess I know what I need to add to my to-do list this week.
There's so many community-created sites in the MTG space that we can't remember what we did without, like, Scryfall, 17 Lands, and now MTG Scribe. Maybe you'll have the next great idea, and Squarespace can help you make that dream a reality.
Check out squarespace.com for a free trial, and when you're ready to launch, go to squarespace.com/LOL to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. And now, back to the show.
All right, it takes us on to our next part of the format here. This is what I put in here, which is mental fortitude. We haven't talked about this much since our Making Your Own Luck episode.
Very apt that we're bringing it back for a set that has the card, Make Your Own Luck.
Well, but I think I've been trying to do this for myself. And like I said, I've been having a blast in the format, but it is my instinct as a Magic player, like when I get 2-for-1, is to feel bad, to feel like the game's over. But I think you can get 2-for-1 like 4, 5, 6 times in this format and still come back and win the game. Like the power level that takes place in the games is wild. And I think one of the things that green, white, and green, red do so well as beatdown decks is a lot of their rares say, kill me now, or I'm going to give you a good advantage every single turn. That's really hard to come back from. But if you can kill them, you can stop that. And if you can tank that advantage they get for a couple turns and just hold on and then play your big swingy thing, there's a lot of cards that can make up for, you know, getting 2-for-1 4 or 5 times in the format. So just if you've got those style of cards in your deck, and hopefully you do if you're wanting to get to the late game, try to just hang in there while you're getting 2-for-1 and just let it be a bit more normal of a thing than it is in a game of Magic. But I think the other thing to be aware of with this format is, like, same as any other format, there's going to be games that you just can never win. Whatever, like, I don't remember who it was, but one time on LR, or I don't know, someone was talking about, like, you know, 40% of games, like, you can fight and swing one way or the other. 30% you're always going to lose. 30% you're always going to win. So it's that 40% in the middle that matters, like getting your edge there to try to get to your 70% win rate or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But the 30% of games you lose in this format feel so deflating. Like you just get savagely crushed, or your opponent plays a card that invalidated everything you did. And it's easy to feel like, well, this is stupid. But you're going to have those cards some of the time. I don't know how I'm on team rares all of a sudden, but you're going to have those rares some of the time. And I think you're going to be able to pit the rares against each other to put push pull back and forth in the game. And I think you just need to be ready for tempo changes. And I think that's one of the things I like about this format, because I like those swings of
you're very offense, good defense, at evaluating offense, those.
Defense. Yeah. Yes. And I think honing in on what actually matters. And it doesn't matter that I'm getting 2-for-1 over subsequent turns here. It doesn't matter that my opponent's drawing 2 cards a turn for the next 4 turns, because I can do this. Like, if I can just make it to here, like, really the format rewards identifying, yes, there are a lot of good, powerful things happening, but what's the one of those that matters most and why?
I had one of the, like, craziest games ever on stream earlier this week. And, like, it just was like haymaker into haymaker, like just things that felt like, well, this certainly is going to decide the game. And like that happened 6 times for like either me or my opponent. And like maybe that's the cube aspect of it, but it's more interactive than cube in that respect, I think, like when you're both sort of firing on all cylinders like that. And I agree, there were definitely like many spots in the game where I was like, I'd like to concede now. I'd like to be done with this because it feels like I can't come back, but sometimes you can.
Well, I think the other thing I would like just throw out here in the mental fortitude section, I think this format can feel horrible if you only get a draft a couple times a week or something. Like it's much easier to say, well, let it roll off you, like, because I'm drafting whatever, 10, 15 times a week. I think if you only get a draft a couple times a week and you want to have a good time and you want to win, truly, I would recommend drafting green, because it's straightforward. You're going to get to play powerful cards. And I think if you only get a draft a couple times a week, trying to figure out the exact mix of cards you need to make a great Grixis control deck is tough, or trying to figure out the exact amount of synergy or the exact right mana base to play all five of your late game bombs and get there without dying from the green decks. Like, there's a lot of intricate format knowledge that you need to make that stuff happen. And so, yes, those decks are possible, but if you only get to do it once or twice and you want to have a good time and you don't want to just auto lose to a lot of bombs, I think those green beatdown decks, or just drafting green in general, because you'll probably get past some A's of your own, is a good place to be.
Yeah, I went on a journey not only with like understanding the format, and I still feel like I have a lot to learn, but also of like my win rate. Like, first few drafts on Magic Online were 1-2s, next few were 2-1s, then finally got my 3-0s rolling. Like, I have 3 trophies there now. But I have also had, and I don't remember the last time I felt this way in a format, like actual train wrecks.
Oh, really?
I've had multiple train wreck drafts where, like, so I feel like the drafts I understand how to navigate, and I'm kind of jumping ahead a little bit, but I'm curious if it sounds like you haven't had this experience, so maybe you'll have some words of wisdom for me and by proxy our listeners. The drafts where I open powerful stuff, I understand how to like hold on to that for dear life, or how to appropriately navigate holding on to that. I know how to do that. I know how to draft a deck with a plan that is open, whether that's an aggro deck like red-black outlaws, or green-white mounts. I know how to do that. Whether it's a blue-based control deck, I'm figuring that out. Like, I understand that when those pieces are coming around. When those two things don't happen, like, I don't see powerful cards, and then I like maybe am push down. Oh, I think I'm going to do outlaws. I got a fourth pick file smasher. Let's see. Oh, that's gone now. I don't know how to pivot in those spots. And so then I'm like, well, let's just hold on and get to pack two. And then pack two doesn't pan out. And I'm just like, I'm done. Like, this draft is a true blue train wreck. Help me, Ben. Help me not.
Interesting.
Train wreck.
I mean, I think some of that's got to be MTGO to Arena, because there on Arena, there's just no shortage of powerful cards running around the pods. So, like, I think my advice to you probably wouldn't be applicable, but it would just be to stay open, because you're going to eventually get past some good cards, and then you just figure out how to put as many good cards in your deck as possible.
But if those as many good cards in your deck as possible aren't bombs, like, let's say you're getting a smattering of good uncommons that perhaps like require fixing, then you also need fixing, but your power level like isn't actually quite there to go toe to toe with the decks that do get the real powerful stuff. You know, like, I've got a deck right now that is blue-white control, splashing green for 2 copies of Make Your Own Luck and the white-green 1/4 lifelink flyer steed. And the steed, like, I think there is something here in this Bant control life, because you get steer clears so late. And when you can have steer clears be 4 damage for 1 mana, it's like goes back to the Snakeskin Veil thing. Like, you really get to do, like, that is a very powerful way to swing a game of Magic. If you get to double spell plus hold up steer clear type of thing. But like, even that feels like I'm doing a lot of work in the draft and deck building to sort of cobble together. Like, you can hear me be like, it's Bant control steeds. Can I interest you in that? You're like, I don't think so, but you know. So
that sounds functional to me. So would you describe that as a train wreck draft?
No, this felt like I'm 1-1 with it right now. Hopefully I'll 2-1 with it. But like, it feels like a good deck, not a great deck, but like, that's kind of weird. It's kind of a wild scene.
But that's one of the things I like about the format, is that I think despite there being really powerful cards everywhere, the drafts are not obvious. And there's a lot of tension in, well, do I abandon ship for this super busted card that I got past? I don't know. I got like 7 cards in these 2 colors. Can we swing it? Like, sure, why not? that's been my stance on Arena. And I'm curious to dive into MTGO with you. But I certainly think on Arena, the default when you have nothing clear, the decks I can't stop drafting are like green 4 color good cards. And they're not great decks. Like, this has been the format I have trophied the least in with the best win rate and had the most fun. First of all, the rank bug, like where I don't see the pips go up and down, is just incredible in best of one. I'm much happier.
For your mental fortitude.
Much happier not seeing my rank move around. And then the other thing is, I've trophied once, I think, and I've probably drafted, I don't know, 15, 20 times at this point. But
you don't have to advertise everything on the show.
King of the 5-3, 6-3, like draft whatever deck I want to draft. And only a couple times have I like 0-3. I 0-3'd once, gotten 2-3 a couple times, but generally just like 5-3s, 6-3s, living my own best life, doing whatever I feel like doing. Not that that's helpful for you in your draft question. So I don't think I necessarily have an answer for you. And I also have felt a bit lost in the draft at times, which is why I think I keep ending up in that green deck, because certainly on Arena, I'm very conscious in the best of one queues that like I'm going to be playing against people who did not get lost in their draft and correct, just drafted green white mounts A version, like where I'm going to be dying, or they drafted, you know, they got past 4 or 5 rares that shouldn't get passed, or that had to get passed because of, you know, somebody opened a pack with 3 busted rares. So you know the decks in Diamond or Mythic or whatever that you're playing against in best of one are going to be juiced. So I'm very conscious of, oh man, I don't have enough power, or oh, I'm not in a clear enough lane like to compete with those decks.
Yeah. Yeah,
that's well, where maybe, that's where I struggle.
Maybe I'll start sending you some draft logs of some train wrecks, and you can say, well, what are you doing here?
So, yeah, please. That'd be helpful. Listen, you know I love a good log.
I know. All right. Chat to me about some pillars of the format. How are you seeing things shake out archetype-wise?
Yeah, I think we've talked about it. We've alluded to it. But I think the two most straightforward level one kill you decks in the format are green-white and green-red. I think green-white is better than green-red, but both are quite good. And they hit you really hard. It's everything you've been talking about. It's just stats for a good rate, backed up with throw from the saddle, which is part of the reason these decks are incredible, is the gold uncommons are quite strong, and mm-hmm. they get one of the best removal spells because it kills everything while also giving you a bonus, which snowballs you to just put your opponent in such a bad spot. If you're drafting these, you want to be focused, beat down, you want to get the game over with early, but sometimes your card quality is good enough that you can still just compete in the late game as well. And I think these decks are largely pauper decks in a Prince format, which is cool. Mm. And I think they've got some rares that certainly juice them up and help them along. But I think you can be pretty happy with commons and uncommons in green, white, and green, red, which is probably why they're doing as well as they are on 17 lands.
Yeah. Yeah. That checks out for me. I've not played green, red yet myself, but I have played green, white, like a really good version, and obviously faced it. And it's awesome. I mean, throw from the saddle, but also being able to, like, you just stick a powerful threat, and all of your threats are big. And oftentimes, Snakeskin Veil, and to a lesser extent, Take Up the Shield, are just so game-breaking because your opponent is spending, whatever, 4 mana, 5 mana to get something off the battlefield, and you protect it, and then you probably are, that's nail in the coffin.
Yeah, and I've played green-red. I haven't played green-white yet, mostly just because I know it's good, and that style of deck doesn't appeal to me, so I don't feel like there's much to learn there, but I have quite a bit of experience losing to green white and can confirm that it is the real deal.
Yeah.
And next would be like the base green multicolored soup decks with late game bombs, green desert decks, however you want to call them. They're generally base blue green and base green black, and green black can be just green black, but so much of the time you're incentivized to splash for a bomb of some color in these two archetypes. And you can be base green white or base green red and still do these soup decks as well. You're just going to value different cards than the other archetypes. I think the one thing I would say here is to draft this deck with caution, because I've drafted this deck quite a bit. And what you're signing up for when you draft late game bomb soup is you're signing up to see all of your opponent's bombs as well. And this really is like the thing that all the old pros talk about in Sealed or in Draft, like where you just both flip up your decks.
Yeah.
And whoever's deck's better is going to win because you're going to see all the cards. That really is true with that archetype. So, and I think that's another place where it can get frustrating in the format where you're like, I'm doing all this stuff. I'm taking the bombs. I'm playing the best cards I saw, and I'm still just losing to my opponent's bombs. Like, that's going to happen some of the time with this deck, in addition to just getting steamrolled by the green beatdown decks.
Yeah. Makes sense. I would like to draft multicolor soup decks, but I have not yet.
Just get on best of one, baby.
Nah, we'll I can't
queuing them up.
I can't do it. There's 2-color streamlined synergy decks. I think mostly that exists in red, black outlaws and red, white aggro. You really need to be focused on closing out the game early. These are the decks that I think go under your opponents. And I also think you want to be really aware of rate in these decks too. Like something that I was really excited about at Knife Point before, especially because of how it pairs with Vile Smasher, the 3-2. Vile Smasher is great, right? Like black-red 3-2, That's a good rate. Plus, gonna, you know, chip in for damage with outlaw ETBs, and obviously synergizes well with that knife point. But it's just, that's too much of a, like, I'm trying to do a little thing. You would just be much happier playing a three drop that affects the board like 9.9 out of 10 times than playing at knife point. So think about rate in those decks as well.
It's too small ball. Like, yes, that's at knife point is incremental advantage. Incremental advantage is not good in this format. Like that, it's too close to an engine. And I think engines are terrible because there's too many cards that single-handedly are way better than all the work you did to assemble your
correct
incremental advantage.
Yes. Yep.
So it's just not the name of the game. And I think red, white aggro also, similarly, both of these, like, you have to have aggressive cards plus have your synergy lineup plus be able to interact with your opponent's cards. It's tough. These decks have hard match. They're good against, I think, generally the Grixis control decks. They have tough matchups against the green decks because the green decks are almost mid-range beatdown decks.
Yeah.
That are still really fast. And you just get, like, green's just a touch bigger than you everywhere. It's mm-hmm. it's hard. But not to say that they can't work. I do think certainly if you've got rares and or, you know, reasons to do it, you should not be shying away from red, black, or red, white.
I feel like green soup decks are the decks we always talk about as being like, okay, but the recipe is really intricate. You have to have your bombs and your fixing and your card advantage or card filtering plus your removal. Like, I honestly think the two color streamlined synergy decks or
that aren't aggro green.
Decks that aren't green, they have probably an even more complicated recipe because you're like, you need your good cards, plus you need some synergy pieces, but the synergy pieces have to be on rate, plus you need removal, plus your removal or tricks have to be like cheap enough so they interact favorably. Like, it's just a lot going on. Got to be threat dense.
But when you do get that recipe together pops off, ooh, feels so good on some of those two color decks. Mm-hmm. So I do think there's stuff there as well. I would say those decks are probably behind this next class of decks, which is Grixis Crime Control. So either blue-red or blue-black or any combinations thereof. And I think you could say, well, but blue-red and blue-black can be tempo aggro too. And I think they can, but I just think they're not very good. It has the same problem then as red-black outlaws and red-white aggro. You do all this work to get your synergy pieces together for what? Like, it's just not quite good enough. But I think Grixis Crime Control is good enough because they have such a good matchup against the level one green decks, and they also have a lot of game against the bombs decks. You just have to make sure that you can deal with your opponent's bombs, and sometimes you can't, and then you're going to lose there then. But they're classic control decks, like really trying to get card advantage, trade one for one with removal spells on stuff, you know, just light up the green decks. And yes, they can have Take Up the Shield. Yes, they can have a timely Snakeskin Veil. But a true Grixis control deck, I think, can fight through that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
They can, again, like I said, struggle against some of the bombs in the format. But you need to make sure, if you're on these Grixis control decks, that you really have a good late game plan. Or why do you want the game to go late? So it's not just enough to be packing the removal spell and the card advantage. I think you do need some late game finishers of your own in the deck as well.
Yeah.
Or Deep Muck Desperado. I do think Mill is a real late game win con in the format.
Desperado plus Bloodseeker.
Yeah.
It's Desperado. Desperado plus Bloodseeker and blue black is big. So you get to mill for five with the ETB committing a crime. It's not crazy. Plus you can copy with the uncommon clone, the Desperado, and then you get your double mills.
I punted a game yesterday. I have a blue-black crime control deck right now.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, great. I'm a little short on playable, so I have three Phantom Interferences, which is the counter it unless they pay two and make a 2/2 flyer. And I had gotten them to where they had nine cards in their library, and I was ahead. And I was like, great. All I need them to do is play one spell, and I'm going to cast all three of these.
Oh.
And they're going to mill three each time, and then it only triggers once a turn.
Yeah.
And I lost to Rise of the Varmints, making like 20 Varmints.
Oh, gosh. Yeah. Flipping up your deck, seeing everything. The decks that don't really have a place, I'm definitely in for white-black being on this list. And blue-white, I think, is still out for me. The thing that's interesting about blue, I would almost lump blue-white into the Grixis Crime Control.
The true control.
Life.
Yes.
Like it's because it's just all of those decks, control decks in the format are base blue. That is what blue does best, I think, so far in the format, is play a controlling game. I do think that, like, you know, we said that maybe the counterspell last week was on notice. I don't think so. You said, I think it's only good in blue-based control decks. Obviously, that is true. And when you get away from certainly, so here's a great point. Like, we just listed blue red, and we're not talking about blue red double spell at all. And the reason blue red double spell, if you paid attention to the early format data and blue red is in last, the reason that that theme doesn't work is that it asks you to sometimes play off curve for small bonuses. It asks you to say, hey, if you wait a little bit, then you'll get to do this thing. But anytime you're incentivized to do that, the little thing you get isn't going to be good enough for the loss of tempo in the game you're going to feel from not, you know, just playing your cards when you should.
Well, and I think that's ostensibly because blue-red double spell, at least the way a lot of the cards look, is that it wants to be like a synergy aggro deck or like a tempo aggro deck to me. But I do think there are good plot cards in the blue control decks.
For so sure.
Just not blue-red double spelling for the sake of double spelling.
I just think like the more you play blue-red and blue-white, not worrying so much, like it will happen if it's good for you that you double spell. Yes. And then maybe something that is good for you will trigger. But like, you want those things to be at their base good for you and not fiddly things, because these decks, as control decks often are, you're just operating from behind at the start. And that's another thing, like the blue control decks, and this may be an archetype worth diving into deeper in a later week, but like, you need, your curve has to be so excellent in those decks, because you need to have something early, like either on board or to remove their stuff early, so that you can actually leverage your counter spells later in the game.
The best blue uncommon, I think, for enabling those strategies is Canyon Crab.
That card is so good.
The one in a blue 05, and then if you don't do anything, it lets you loot at the end of your turn. Mm-hmm. That card is one of the best ways to start a control shell.
Yes, I totally agree. Ooh, a control shell?
Ooh.
I couldn't agree more. I think, like, that card blocks everything. It lets you see more of your deck, digging to your answers, whatever, and then just interacts so favorably with plotting. One of my favorite things is getting to, you plot Slickshot Lockpicker.
Oh, cast that card.
Cast the thing from your graveyard. You're still triggering your crab because you didn't cast anything from your hand. So good.
Yeah. Slickshot Lockpicker is my pet card in the format. I cannot pass that card.
Card is excellent. Yeah.
That and Rise of the Varmints. Those are the two cards that derail my drafts most frequently.
But yeah, I think so. Then for me, like, I think blue white is really like just a blue control deck using some white removal spells. And white black for me is like the archetype that just doesn't click yet of the 10 color pairs.
Yeah, I would certainly buy that about blue white. Yeah, absolutely. All right, that takes us on to color rankings. And normally I'm the person that is the driving force behind our color rankings, our archetype rankings. I'm sure our tier list is a mess. I will update it as soon as we are done with this episode. So if you want to check out our tier list, it will be up to date with accurate information. I did that as quickly as possible the last time I was doing it because I was overwhelmed by the number of bonus sheets and OTPs and whatever. There was just too many cards in that tier list. But now that I've played with them, it'll be more accurate. So color rankings, I care the least about them I have ever cared about, I think, in a format, just because I think the rares dictate where you should go so much. Like, if, yes, blue is not great from what people tell me, but if you open a great blue rare, you should take your great blue rare and you should play it. Or if you open a great red rare, you should take your great red rare and play it. So I don't think you should shy away from any colors just because you've heard that green is good. Is green good? Yes. Are the rares in every other color good?
Yes.
Yes, definitely. So I think the colors are probably, for me, something like green is equal to black. Maybe green's a little bit better than black. Green's probably better than black just because of how good the level one green beatdown decks are. Mm-hmm. So let's say green one, black two. I would say like red and blue in third and fourth place. And I would still have white in last, mostly because I think white doesn't give the other decks much.
Like, white green, isn't white, the base of any deck. You think about green, white, white is supplementing green. White is supplementing blue in the control decks. White, black isn't great. White is supplementing red in the aggro life. Like, maybe it's sort of going toe to toe thanks to trained Aryx, but like, white just, it's helping, but it's not the star.
Yes. And I think certainly, though, there's good white rares. Can you take them? Play good white decks? Yes, absolutely. But I think the power level of the cards you see in the draft matters way more than any sort of static color power rankings.
Yeah. All right. So those are the big picture life. You'll be joining me in the MTGO streets maybe this week. Maybe
I'll get kicked out of the content creator program, one of the two.
Okay. Fair. Firm but fair. Let's chat a little bit about, you know, it's been a week, certainly 2 weeks since the crash course, to try and solidify some top commons or slash top uncommons in each of these colors. And a lot of this, I think, doesn't matter. Just kind of weird. Like, it's so contextual. And this, again, may be a play booster thing. But a lot of these commons, like, you're just not getting into colors for commons. I mean, you're really not getting. Yeah, you're not getting into any colors for commons, but you're certainly not getting into white or blue at common, are you?
Well, you could. I mean, like, it just depends. You're really sad, I think, if your draft starts with a common for the most part. Like, there's, you should be picking a rare or an uncommon. So it's different. Like, even in Murders at Karlov Manor, like, a lot of the white commons drew you into white.
That's true. Yeah.
Here, like, even the green commons, I don't know that the green commons are really the reason you're getting into green. Maybe Throw from the Saddle. I could see that one for sure. Mm. But other than that, they just have a lot of good deep commons once you already happen to be green.
Yeah, I think top of the heap for white would be Trained Arynx. That's the one in a white 3-1 saddle 2. If it attacks when saddled, it gets first strike and you scry one. Cards of beating.
Yes, it's the best aggressive 2-drop in the format. Like, maybe you could make a case for Bristlepack Sentry in green, but that is some setup required. That's the one in a green 3-3. Trained Arynx has attacks the first three turns of the game with next to no work.
And the other common to shout out, I think, is a Mystical Tether, the 2-white enchantment removal spell that can pay 2 extra to have it have flash. Just slots into that catch-all removal life.
Is it? Is that card good?
Yes, I think it is good. And I know you want to hate it, but I think that card is good.
I don't like Mystical Tether.
Why?
I don't know. I don't have good reasons other than, like, a very visceral, ugh, I don't like this thing that much. I'm sorry.
I don't know.
I have no rational explanation, which probably means it's okay. But yeah, it's hard for me to make myself take it.
And I am still with you on not being, like, even though Take Up the Shield is high in the all user power rankings, I think among top users, Take Up the Shield, it's still in the top 10, top white common for top users. So we're probably wrong about it. I just think, like, I've not been excited by this card. I think it's fine in green white specifically.
Yeah, that's what I would say.
Snakeskin Veil does it better.
I think you're picking Trained Arynx over Take Up the Shield if you're white, like, all the time. I think.
I would think so. This was like someone earlier this week, like, I had a game where Snakeskin Veil was an absolute beating, and someone was like, man, Snakeskin Veil's got to be the best common, right? I was like, no. I was like, I mean, I don't even know by what, it depends how you're, like, whatever, what you're referring to, like, cheapest way to have the most impactful play, maybe, but, like, even if you think it's so good, like, you can't load up on that effect. That's the poster child for a diminishing returns card. Like, the first copy is really important. Second copy, not so much. Third copy, definitely not so much.
Right. Well, and I think the difference for Take Up the Shield for me in this format is, and granted, I have not cast a lot of them yet. So again, willing to be wrong here, but my feeling is that in prior formats, I would see Take Up the Shield as, oh, white's open, I need to move into a white aggro deck. And I don't feel like white aggro decks are good enough that I should let Take Up the Shield push me into white here. Will I happily play a Take Up the Shield in my white beatdown deck? Yes, but it's not, like, going to get me to go into white the way it has in the past.
Yep.
All right, that takes us on to blue. I really don't think the blue commons matter that much in the sense that, like, none of them should be pushing you into blue. The one that has really been impressive to me over the last 3 to 4 days has been Jailbreak Scheme. That's the blue sorcery with Spree, where you can pay 2 to put a creature on the top or the bottom they choose of their library. Or you can pump it with another +2 to give something +1/+1 and make it unable to be blocked. That mode's been super relevant as well.
I've lost, like, to that mode multiple times.
Right, because there's a lot of board stalls happen in the format, and somebody has, like, a 9/9 plant token from casting their Tumbleweeds card or whatever, and then you make that unblockable and turn it into a 10/10, and the game's over like that, which is really powerful to just have incidentally tacked on to
a good removal spell.
A blue interactive spell.
Yeah, and there's a non-zero amount of, you know, like you just mentioned, the Tumbleweeds or Rise of the Tumbleweeds or whatever. Like, it's a non-zero amount of big dumb tokens running around that this just kills, plus, like, again, if your opponent is happens to be on some sort of fiddly accruing value Grixis deck, Jailbreak Scheme just laughs at that. You're like, I've grown my whatever Blood Hustler to a 4/4, and they're like, too bad. And then you're like, well, I can't draw it again, so I guess it goes to the bottom.
Yep.
Yeah. Okay.
And I have liked Phantom Interference as well. And I know the card has felt terrible, but the times it feels good, it's so good. Like, I think you're willing to play it. It's almost like a necessary evil because you're going to get yourself in spots where it is a bad Magic the Gathering card in your deck. But I think I want it in decks that have a lot of filtering. And I think blue provides a lot of ways to loot or draw cards and things like that. And I think despite it being really bad sometimes, it's a good card. You're not going to need to pick it highly during the draft, but you're going to play it because when it hits, it's so bonkers when it hits.
Yeah. Well, and I think its flexibility is good enough. Like the fact that, again, blue decks maybe aren't always going to want this, but you probably are going to end up with some number of, like the crab, for example. Just the fact that you get to affect the board, the turn cycle, you have a crab in play, but still get the loot with the crab to then flash in a 4-mana 2/2 flyer. And the 2/2 flyer trades with stuff, you know, like, you get to flash that in and trade with their whatever, the black 4/2 warlock that makes you discard a card, you know, stuff like that. Like you just get, it's good enough. I think Phantom Interference is good enough.
A ringing endorsement from Lords of Limited. Good enough.
It's the top blue common among all users and top users on 17 lands. Yeah.
Oh, wow. So, that's shocking to me.
Yeah.
Because it's felt horrible like a lot of the time.
I mean, it's not a ringing endorsement. It doesn't have a high rate. Like blue is obviously not where you want to be commons wise, but among those commons, it is the best.
The best of the worst. You love to see it.
Okay. Black, a bit of an upset here, I think. I put Consuming Ashes number one over Vault Plunderer. And this loops back to my growing pains story at the start of the episode, but like Consuming Ashes just does way more of what you need to be doing in the format than Vault Plunderer does.
Ah, but it's a 2-for-1.
It's a 2-for-1, but it just doesn't matter.
But sometimes it does. Sometimes Vault Plunderer is so oppressive.
But like you saw my 3-drop slot, like if you don't get Vault Plunderer, you're going to get something. Like your deck is going to have 2-for-1s in it. Your deck is not necessarily going to have Exile Removal.
My heart feels that too. I almost put Consuming Ashes number one and I was like, nope, I can't do it. I can't do it.
I think we have to.
Like my heart feeling that way, plus you telling me that it's that way. I guess I'll co-sign Consuming Ashes 1.
It's just years of us being like, removal stinks, but it doesn't. It doesn't stink.
All right, Consuming Ashes 1, Vault Plunderer 2?
I might want to put Bloodseeker or Desert's Due ahead of Vault Plunderer. I don't know. That's probably an overcorrection, but like, there are no shortage of good things to do for 3-mana, and there is definitely a shortage of good things to do for 2-mana. I think Desperate Bloodseeker is phenomenal.
I agree. Well, it's either very good or irrelevant. Like sometimes it's irrelevant in games too. Like if the game's going big, it really doesn't matter that much. I almost think Desert's Due ahead of Desperate Bloodseeker. But it just depends on the style of deck you're drafting, right? In Grixis Crimes, Desert's Due like 100% of the time because you want to be able to
When Desert's Due kills an X4, like that, like when you're in that territory, it feels like cheating.
Yes. So I kind of want to go, if we're not putting Vault Plunderer 2, I kind of want to put Desert's Due 2.
I'm in for that. I'm in for Ashes 1, Desert's Due 2.
But then like when I'm drafting Rise of the Varmints, I'm picking Desperate Bloodseeker over all of these cards, I think.
I think it's just like Consuming Ashes is the only one of these cards. Like if I see Consuming Ashes 5th, that's me being like, I'll take that as my first black card. I don't feel that way about any of the other ones.
Vault Plunderer is in a really awkward space.
It's
there.
So like, awkward.
But I keep seeing it 5th and 6th pick, and I'm like, okay, I'll draft black. But then, like,
no,
really?
Yeah.
Is it? It's so hard to undo.
I know.
Years of conditioning that Vault Plunderer, and it is an amazing card.
Just not isn't in it? This set.
Just not in this set. Yeah. Ugh. All right. Takes us on to red. Explosive Derailment in the number one slot. That's the red spree card where you can pay an extra 2 to deal 4. You can also blow up an artifact alongside it. If you're here to do both those things, oh boy, does it feel good.
Oh my God, I've had that. I've not done it impactfully, but I've had it done to me, blown up some sweet artifacts and
people. Boy, does that up feel your bad. Golden egg. Doesn't feel good.
Yeah. Well, you can blow up my silver deputy. That's fine.
Number two, prickly pear. Two and a red for the 2/2 brings along a mercenary with it. Number three, jury's out for me here on Reckless Lackey. This might not be good enough. I haven't played with it since like the first couple days. I drafted red a lot the first 2 days of this week. And I really liked Reckless Lackey because it's so good against Trained Arynx. It's so good against the mercenary tokens. It lines up well against a lot of things in the format, but it is kind of small ball. Like greens, 3/3s, and 4/4s just kind of laugh at your Reckless Lackey. I don't know. Jury's out for me on that one. And I could see Thunder Salvo going ahead of it again, just because cheap interaction. You're willing to pay 2 mana for 2 damage. And sometimes it does 3/4. And again, if you get it into that range, much like Deserts do, I think Thunder Salvo is a good card.
Yeah, I think, again, beyond Explosive Derailment and maybe even Derailment isn't part of this. Like, I'm just not getting into red for these cards. And that is, again, the take for me is like, Prickly Pear ain't it. Erasable Wolverine is not it.
But normally if you see Prickly Pear 5th, 6th, like, that's like, okay, I'll think about drafting red. And it's hard. That's, I think, where I'm struggling in the drafts is seeing those cards.
Yes.
And just like having to push them down to does not pull me into red.
Well, and it's this hard thing because like it often will be like it probably is the air quotes best card in the pack at that point. But then when you take like either you need to say I'm not taking it because I've already got other stuff going on and I just want to get deeper into these colors or these strategies, or you take it, but you're not giving it weight. You're like, OK, I'll take this. Either red has to flow now or I need red to be open. Like I need to open good red stuff in pack two, but I'm not giving this the weight of like now I'm going to try and get into red for this 6th pick prickly pear.
Yeah, that makes sense.
All right, talk to me about green.
Green, number one, easy throw from the saddle. I think this is probably the best common in the format, would be my guess. It's just so strong in the green decks, and the green beatdown decks are so good. One in a green, +1/+1 counter. Something deals damage equal to its power to an opposing creature. If your creature was a mount, it gets a +1/+1 counter instead. That card is incredible.
Yeah, cosine.
Number two.
And 17 lands cosines as well.
Number two, Patient Naturalist, 2 and a green, 2/3, ETBs, you mill 3, you can put a land in your hand. If you whiff, you get a treasure token instead. That's a bit at odds with like green, white and green, red. So it's hard to know, like you're going to know which green cards you want, depending on what style of green decks you're drafting. I have played a boatload of Patient Naturalists in this format. It's a very good card. What I was going back to those green multicolored soup decks, the amount of air you have. Like, if you've got a deck with 17 lands and 3/4 Patient Naturalist because you want to hit land drops, but you've only got, like, 4 key cards, you really need to make sure you have Recursion, too, because it can be disastrous. You know, normally you're just supposed to not really care about what you mill because maybe it was going to be on the bottom of your deck, but a lot of times you're going to get to the bottom of your deck playing those late-game style decks. So you can have too many Patient Naturalists or too much. Like the 2/3 body is just not good enough when you get into those wars of Haymaker on Haymaker. But it's been a good card. Number three, Bristlepack Sentry. That's the one in a green, 3/3.
This is surprising to me that this is so high on your list.
What do you like instead of it?
Well, I am surprised to see neither of the fatty boom booms on your list. In Spinewood's Paladin, that's the 5 mana, 5/4 trample. Gain 3 life on an ETB and plot for 4. And the card another card I poo-pooed and have to mea culpa is Cactarantula.
Are they good?
They're very good.
Very good?
Like, I haven't cast a lot of Cactarantulas. I've faced a lot of Cactarantulas. That card's a beating. It's really hard to not get 2-for-1 by it. It's really, if you are, like, if you can answer it, like, Cactarantula's kryptonite is fake your own death. That is the way to favorably get Cactarantula off the board. It's attack with a 3-power thing, then fake your own death, get it back. They don't get a card. Otherwise, if you're lucky, you 2-for-1 with it. And if not, it just sits there, blanking all of your evasive threats.
Yeah, I have not cast it because I don't value it very highly. And maybe I'm wrong about that because that's what I've heard other people talking about. I'm just like, I that's the one. Those two cards are two the jury's out for me on yet. Like,
interesting.
I see the green white beatdown life with saddles, mounts. I've experienced that many times, but I've also not played against tons of paladins.
Oh, interesting. Ranchos,
and I've played against green a lot, which is why I, and when they have been on the battlefield, I haven't felt, maybe I'm just like living in my own weird bubble.
I also think Paladin is like pretty good as a, like if you're already splashing, like let's say you're blue black, you've got a villainous wealth, your blue black control, you got a villainous wealth, and you got good fixing. Throw a couple Spinewoods Paladins in your blue black control deck, man. That card is just, it's big and it gains you life. I'm just saying.
I believe you, but that is not on my radar at all. Like both of those cards, certainly Spinewood Paladin, I was very high on, and I moved it down pretty quickly. So maybe I need to revisit.
This also might be me coming from a early lot of fiddly Grixis decks, and like those two cards just laugh at little derpy ground creatures or whatever.
It's your 1-2 Raven.
Exactly. Just like, who cares?
I do think Cactarantula can stall out the board. Like the thing that Cactarantula has done when it hits the board is
the game grinds to a halt.
The game grinds to a halt. So then if you have a way to capitalize on that, I could see it. But the things I've been most impressed by out of green decks are green, white, and green, red.
Mm.
And Spinewood Paladin is certainly great in green, red. But neither one of those decks, I don't think, is super hot on Cactarantula. Cactarantula is more, maybe I need to be putting that in my five color
deck. In your green soup decks, I feel like both of those cards need, you got to bump those up in your pick order.
Ain't nobody got time for that. I just like they're in the middle. Like I'm making sure I don't die in the first few turns and then casting haymakers. Like those are, both of those are, seem small ball to me in the interesting deck. But so much of that is arena too. Like the wars you get into in the green late game decks are just absurd. Like those cards are so small ball compared to the haymakers people are casting to me. But I have heard other people, so maybe I'll revisit those. I'm certainly willing to say I'm wrong about those two cards.
Okay.
Sorry. I'm sure listeners will chime in and let us know too.
Yeah, for sure. And please do, because we need as much info as we can get.
Yeah. But the Bristlepack Sentry curve outs have been the things that have been the most scary to me. When I'm playing a non-green deck and I want to get to the late game and my opponent plays Sentry on two, I'm like, because they followed up with a four power thing and they're swinging with that, and they have a, you know, heaven forbid they have a Snakeskin Veil to just grow it into a 4/4 permanently when I try to kill one of the things.
Yep,
it's tough.
Yeah, I buy it.
And I think Heartbristle Bandit too. People are talking about this card. You're out.
I'm still out on Bandit, but
I'm still out also. This is one of green 1/1 taps adamant of any color. I have seen it be good, so I think mischaracterized it maybe in the sense of, you know, unplayable or whatever, but I am still kind of out on it too. But so many people, I have to be wrong, we have to be wrong, right? So many people are saying, oh, Heartbristle Bandit's good.
I think like the only deck I'm interested in it in is green soup.
It's not pulling you into it. Like,
it's certainly not pulling me into it, and it's,
and I think it's worse than Dance of the Tumbleweeds or
Fragile
whatever
is all get out. And like, yeah, like I would buy that it's worse than Dance of the Tumbleweeds. I don't know. I have rarely been in, I've not played with it very much myself. I've faced it a lot, rarely been impressed by it. There have been a few times where like it's like, oh wow, yeah, it really lets you do some things that then never amounted to, like, then you never got punished for playing a 2-mana 1/1 later in the game. Like, yes, it was like Sol Ring for you multiple times.
Those are the draws where it's been most impressive to me. When I haven't had removal,
mm-hmm.
and they've gone like that into ramp out a 4-drop rare, into ramp out a 5-drop rare or whatever.
Yeah.
Those are the times that it shines, I think.
Right. So I'm not, and it's not very high in the green power rankings on 17 lands, which sort of makes me feel like it hasn't been from jump. Like it wasn't in, and I'm looking at now.
Okay, great. Card's terrible. 17 lands says it's bad. It must be bad.
It's ninth among top users of green commons. Like, that's not a ringing endorsement.
All right, I love it.
Doesn't mean it's bad, but just like this card is not pulling you into green by any stretch.
All right, I take it back. No apologies to Heartbristle Bandit.
Great.
All right. Nobody's got time for top uncommon re-ranks here. We've got them listed in the show notes. If you're on the Patreon tier where you can check out our show notes, you can look at the top uncommons there. I think probably you could just look at 17 lands and see which uncommons are great.
We shouted out Canyon Crab, which I think is worth the shout out there. And like Canyon Crab, Prairie Dog, you have as the top white uncommon here. That just like, it's again, we're in a spot, I think, where the good twos are just so premium. And that's why Canyon Crab and Prairie Dog deserve your respect. It's why I'm so high on Bloodseeker at the moment, is like, and not to say the Bloodseeker is as good as these, but like, and you did say sometimes it's blank, but a lot of times it's not. And like, depending on your strategy, it might be like instrumental to it. If you're black, green, self mill, if you're trying to commit crimes, like, I just think the good twos like that really need to go up, 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 up in your pick order.
And Stubborn Burrow Fiend as well in green, the one on a green 2/2.
Oh, that, yeah.
Battle to mill 2. That one's also incredible. The other uncommons really impressed me that I have moved way up is Longhorn Sharpshooter. And maybe I was just way too low on that to start with. But every time my opponent has plotted that, killed something, I have just, it's just been backbreaking.
Well, and reach on that, secret or not, is incredible. Like, because yes, that's the strategy where both halves of this are just like, is when you're facing like, whatever, someone who's trying to tempo you out or someone who's control and is trying to win with 2/2 flyers, like Sharpshooter is just excellent there.
All right. Any parting thoughts about this gem of a draft format so far?
Certainly the podcaster in me is very excited because I feel like there's a lot of meat on this bone.
Yes. The
competitor in me is very excited about this because I feel like there's a ton that I still don't know and don't understand yet. I feel like there's a ton to explore. Like, feels like we've got this sort of level one green aggro, maybe the level two of some streamlined synergy / aggro decks. But there's a world of blue control decks out there that I'm very excited to dig into in the coming
weeks. I think blue control is better than the two colored streamlined synergy decks, personally. That's where I'm most excited to explore this week.
Yeah, me too. So it sounds like we've got our work cut out for us.
All right, let's do it. And I think my parting thoughts to people would be, if you are struggling or have been off put by the rares, I would say I would encourage people to give this format a second chance. Like, yeah, you're going to have some feel bad losses. But the other thing that goes along with that is when you win hard, it feels so good, too. You really do get the extremes in this format. I think if you've been having a rough time, would encourage you to draft green beatdown decks. But the other thing, that's what I kind of wanted to get into in the draft, not to just open the episode back up again. This is coming back to my head. But I O3'd once yesterday and was like, that felt terrible. I'm just going to draft green beatdown and smash some people. And it wasn't open. Like, I started with a green, white, gold card into some green cards, and then I got cut out of it on Arena. But it was really hard to pivot out of that. Once I got cut out of that, like, once I had
that's
been
what
going
I'm talking
down
about. Yeah, yeah.
Once I'd been going down the green beatdown path and had gotten cut, like, I was like, oh, because like, there's no off ramp from that into like green bombs, because you drafted all like beatdowny stuff. Like, I had trained Arynxes, and like, it was difficult. So I don't think you can just go in blinders. Like, you still need to, despite, you know, we're saying green's good, you still, I do really think you're supposed to let the drafts push you and pull you. But the issue with the format is sometimes if you get pulled in a direction towards a Grixis crime control deck, or you get pulled towards, you know, like, maybe you're supposed to play red, black outlaws in your seat, you really have to know how to build it right to not get rolled by the green deck. So I think this is going to be a tough format for people who don't get to play super frequently. Cause I think, yes, like, it's easy for the discourse to be, yeah, there's a lot of bombs that invalidate the game, the format's stupid. But I think there's so much more going on than that. And I do think you can really mitigate that stuff by having ideal builds of what the archetypes are trying to do.
Yeah. Well, I think,
and not what they're trying to do in quote unquote WotC headlines, but like really how they need to engage with the format.
Right. I definitely think there's a lot of like, ignore the headlines for some of the archetypes and just like focus on the actual rules of engagement for the format that we've outlined this episode. Yeah.
All right. Great place to wrap us up. Go forth, crush some OTJ drafts. Thank you, as always, to Salty Pretzels for our intro and outro music. Make sure you give it a listen.
You can find all of our content at lordsoflimited.com. Ben said he's going to be updating that tier list. Check that out there. Check out our merch, courtesy of TeePublic. I'm sipping my coffee out of my Lords Limited mug right now. You can find our other content via our Twitch channel and our YouTube channel. And you can find our Patreon page as well. All of that good stuff at lordsoflimited.com.
If you've got any feedback about the show or any questions, or you've got a JLK What's the Play submission, shoot us an email at lordsoflimited@gmail.com.
Thanks so much for listening, and we'll catch you next week for another episode of Lords of Limited.
Thanks, everybody. See you later.